is the Norris Group's Real Estate Investor Radio Show, the award-winning show dedicated to thought leaders shaping the real estate industry and local experts revealing their insider tips to succeed in an ever-changing real estate market. Hosted by author, investor, and hard money lender, Bruce Norris.
On Friday, September 27th, the Norris Group proudly presented its 12th annual award-winning black tie event, I Survived Real Estate. An incredible lineup of industry experts join Bruce and Aaron Norris to discuss perplexing industry trends, head-scratching legislation, massive tech disruption, and opportunities emerging for real estate professionals. All proceeds from the event benefit Make-A-Wish and St. Jude Children's Research Hospital. This event is not possible without the generous help of the following platinum partners: the San Diego Creative Real Estate Investors Association, Invest Club, Think Realty, Coach Fullerton, Keller Williams Corona, Property Radar, the Apartment Owners Association, MVT Productions, and Realty 411. Visit isurvivedrealestate.com for event information.
So, you know, back in the day on the real estate agency side, right, a big part of the value proposition for agents was showing properties, right? You had the secret book of listings. You had the secret book of this or that. Obviously, that's gone the way of the dodo, right? So, and you're seeing that more and more. Companies like Zillow, for example, have effectively made leasing agents, right, obsolete, because you can actually generate more leads just throwing it up on Zillow than you could putting it up on your MLS. So I think those in, you know, within the next few years, basically, will be an obsolete life cycle. It's kind of like the toll booth operators, you know, going up and down the Orange Corridor, right? I mean, like, why do that anymore? You know, you no longer need that. So I think those folks are going to disappear within the next, you know, couple few years. Wow. And they're going to have to focus on higher value functions. And I'm okay with that, right? Like, if those relatively low value functions, if your claim to existence basically is that you happen to have the brochure that nobody else has so that you can claim
that those are
your listings, you're going away. You know, and I think that's okay.
It was really interesting to watch Purple Bricks pull out of the U.S. market this year. They were based out here in Irvine. Wow. Apparently, we don't have big fans of Purple Bricks in the audience. I thought it was really early. I was actually very surprised. But they had gotten hammered on stage saying they were, I forgot it was at an Inman conference. Somebody said they were like plumbers that couldn't represent anybody. But they got really hammered. But from a listing agent side, for people who don't think it brings a lot of value, isn't it weird at this time in the cycle that they got pushed out? Is it just because they burned all their cash and they just didn't have a good business model, or what was it?
Well, yeah, I mean, the U.S. market versus, say, the U.K. market and the Australian markets function very, very differently, right? And so to be able to compete in a more of a sort of, you know, an open market economy like they do in the U.S. and run the same model is not going to be successful, right? And the thing that I actually sat on a panel at the DOJ with the CEO of Purple Bricks, actually, in Washington, and the problem that they have is even though they claim to provide full service, the difference between full service and actually providing full service from our perspective as a brokerage is very, very different, right? Their folks are all about, you know, their average real estate agent does about 250 deals a year, right? Whereas your average real estate agent without a team cannot do anywhere near that and provide any sort of service, right? And that was something that became quickly evident. He actually said on the panel when the DOJ attorney asked, you know, what happens if a client calls you and asks you to, you know, help them trim their yard or paint their wall or something like that to get a house ready for sale to maximize their profit? And he said, oh, I don't have time to answer their calls. He said that in front of the government. You know, so I mean, I found it appalling, actually, that, you know, and it's in the public record, so you can look it up. But I mean, that's, you know, you cannot effectively scale to that level with those kinds of costs, and that's why they left.
All right, we'll end with this. Real estate or otherwise, what is the most exciting technology that you're watching that you think will be disruptive in the next 5 years?
5 years.
5 years.
5 years is a little tough.
All right, give me a time frame. It's okay. It's short.
I you know, probably the one I think will have the biggest disruption that people don't really realize, because we've, you know, we've been from 3G to 4G, whatever, the move to real 5G, if we really deploy it, right?
Like, real 5G.
Yeah, you know, my phone pulls up and it says 5G, right, from AT&T, and it's like, what is this? You know, this is a joke. But if we deliver on the true promise of 5G, where there's very low latency, that just latency, if you've been on an international phone call and you have to wait a second to hear, you know, for the other person, that's what latency is. So that gets tighter. It really changes quite a bit, right? And I was trying to come up, you know, yesterday with good examples for you. But, you know, you think about augmented reality, right? Like the glass holes, the Google glasses, and things like that. Well, now you can start having that where you can have a full overlay of a lot of information real time talking to servers rather than having to try to have all that computing power on you. And I think it's going to be a bigger transformation than the internet.
Yeah, Amazon just released the Ring. We're going to wearables. I really think that we're going to be getting away from phone screens in the next 5 years with all the push for wearables, for sure. And 5G, I think, will lead the way.
Yeah, and 5G allows you to put all the computing power somewhere else so you can have less battery power, smaller devices, yep, and a lot richer functionality local. And so maybe that's the end of the phone. It really is going to be disruptive. I don't think in 5 years. I think in 5 years in parts of the world, okay, that are actually investing in things, right? We're laggards now on technology from a large infrastructure basis.
Okay. Mark?
Yeah, I think in 5 years, although it won't be fully out there, I think the autonomous vehicles, as it applies to trucking, will be interesting to follow, because I can't imagine, if you don't have cab forward anymore, what's going to do to all the shipping bays that are out here? Because you could pull the truck in either way. You know, it's a lot of design will change as far as warehousing and commercial property.
It's interesting because the Inland Empire has a lot of warehouse, and because if 5G comes on, all of a sudden all the jobs that people are touting, a lot of that can be happening via 5G connection. In Minneapolis, Target's, that's where they're based. They could be controlling entire warehouses with robotics and internet.
The trucks themselves might be the warehouses.
I'm uncomfortable. Okay, Simon.
I kind of agree with Mark. Like, I'm a big fan of the potential for automated vehicles, but less so for the commercial shipping and more for just all the cars on the road. Like, imagine if all of them actually knew how to drive. You know? And the efficiencies that you could gain from that. But the lady that's responsible for this haircut, which is obviously not very expensive, she bought a Tesla and she spent like 70 grand for this thing. And, you know, I don't know how much she makes, but I'm not paying her a lot. And, and she said that her Tesla, she got the automated driving thing, whatever it's called, so that Elon Musk says that in the next couple of years, that car can go out and make money as an Uber driver by itself, yeah, while she's cutting hair. Right? And I think that's fascinating.
Yeah, when you're done with your lease, the car will drive itself away and the new one will show up.
Exactly.
Yeah. But there's a lot of people that cry because they realize how many more cars are going to be on the road. So for here in California, I have people that say, oh, the traffic's going to be way better. And other people are like, are you kidding me? It's going to be so cheap. Families are going to not be taking their kids to soccer anymore. They're going to be just sending the car. So you're going to go from a two-car household to maybe more.
But think you could have a, because you don't have the way that's oriented, an autonomous vehicle, you can actually buy like a 17th century coach and go around like a king or queen of France. Because of the way the doors open and everything, it'd be fantastic.
Okay. All right, so Dad, I'm handing to you. You have to translate all that to how it impacts real estate and how we live. With that, thank you. We're at dessert time. We are going to start back at 9 o'clock for our last hour. Thanks, guys.
I'm going to end the way I have always ended the event, asking one of these two questions, but I'll put it in your guys' brain right now. Anything keeping you up at night, like a black swan event? And what's the one thing you're most excited about for 2020? So at the end, we'll respond to either one or both of those. There is a question I wanted to ask I haven't asked before, and we can just quickly go down. We'll start on my left. And your favorite source for information, newsletter, podcast, for learning and understanding?
You know what? There's so many, so many out there. I use this little app called Flip Phone, Flip what is it called? I think it's Flip, yeah. Right? Yeah. Right. So it just I'm actually playing into this whole, you know, I'm building an ecosystem of stuff that I only want to hear about, right? So it's just only it pulls data or information, news on things that I pre-select, and I instead of someone telling me what to look at, I pre-select it myself, and it's I actually flip through that literally every morning for about 15 minutes, and I can kind of get all the highlights, and I can start my day. So I like to use that app to kind of get it going.
Now that's for information, or I'm trying to think of what I'm. Maybe I'm not asking it exactly right. Like the people you rely on to tell you what's coming. Maybe that's even more specific. Like a trusted direction.
You know, it is so hard. I mean, that's a tough question. Nowadays, you know, we're able to grab information from so many different places. I just don't feel like I can go. I go to one place anymore.
Okay.
You know, and for me, it's if it's an issue, whether it's politics or economy or whatever, this particular app allows me to kind of look at all the articles that have been written about certain topics. So then you can just read about it from different perspective. I just don't know if there's anyone who, aside from Doug Duncan, I would say I don't really listen to any other economists. So I don't know.
Yeah. Is that going to be a unanimous thing? That's pretty cool.
You people got to raise your standards.
Yes.
You know, it probably sounds incredibly shallow, but I mean, I have Facebook up on one of my monitors all day long, and you know, I have a good sized sphere just having run ERA for quite a long time. And so honestly, you know, your sphere on Facebook is sort of, you know, your peers or people that you respect or that you acknowledge or what have you. And so things that bubble up that seems to be resonating with them tends to, you know, create more awareness on Facebook. And so as shallow as it sounds, I think that's where I get an awful lot of at least what the headlines are. And then I'll click down into, you know, them more to figure out some of the details. Although I do have Flipped on my watch. So
oh, you do have it?
I do.
Oh,
so, yeah. You know, you can check out my watch.
I actually love it. You're able to just instantaneously get all the information you want from lots of different sources. So.
All right. I've been out of the. I don't have not one Flip, not one.
you don't give a Flip?
Yeah, I'm more of an open sourcer. I've been kind of an open source software developer for so many years that I kind of go to this crowdsourcing type model. So I actually read slashdot.org. So slashdot is the word. .org, and they have articles that are really wide ranging, and I get to hear from, you know, people that I've worked with all my career weigh in on different things. So it's kind of a way to get opinion.
Okay, Sean.
Just to be different, I read a lot of science fiction, and and you know it's amazing. Like I mean, a lot of my thoughts on cryptocurrencies and digital currencies, which I know Aaron's interested in. There's a great book, Cryptonomicon, and you know, yeah. Most of these things that you know still seem out there, or that we've seen recently, you know, the internet, cyberspace, all these things, they were all in science fiction first, right? And so I always think about what of those things are close. I mean, not for daily news, obviously, but it's a source of inspiration.
One of the things I'll mention is that for almost 10 years we've been writing in the limo, and most of what he told me was coming, I never even had heard of 8 or 9 years ago. And he's talking about 3D printing and self-driving cars, and I'm just like, what is he talking about? And now here we are. So I really like our rides, because you never know what he's going to say, and I'm a big believer. He's probably right. I just got to figure out if I can even comprehend what he just said. Yes.
I'll go, well, if Doug had a podcast, I'd be listening to that, but he doesn't. So I'll go with Nick Timiraos from the Wall Street Journal, because I know him very well and trust him, and he used to be the housing beat reporter. Now he's the Fed reporter, and I think he calls it like he sees it.
I'm sorry, his name?
Nick Timiraos.
Nick Timiraos,
yeah,
okay.
And I follow him on Twitter. And he tends to like articles and comment on them with some good intel and disagree with people with facts, and I like that.
I talked to him a lot during the foreclosure crisis and I talked to a lot of reporters, and he was definitely one of the brightest, so I could totally see that.
Yeah, he's the Journal's Fed reporter now, too. I'm.
Do you listen to yourself? Is that it?
Nobody else in my house does. Maybe the dog once in a while. I read these things, they're called books. They're like hardcovers and pages, they're printed on paper. I'm a liberal arts guy, so most of the reading that I do when I'm not in the office has nothing to do with economics. So I write history and biography and world events, and because I think that the world of ideas it has a lot to offer economics from people who are not economists, and so I do that. In terms of daily news, I read both the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times every day. And I like things in print. I haven't watched a television news program in 20 years. And in terms of the business, I read, there's probably six or eight other analysts or economists that I read, because I certainly don't know everything. And I like to see the people that differ with me, because it tells me I might not have thought about something. And so I try to do that.
Okay. No YouTube fans. I'm just curious. Am I like a college kid? I actually like that source, and since you guys would understand it better than I kind of got into it, and I wondered, I wonder if I could listen to Jim Rohn teach the same talk he did in 1981, and lo and behold, it was there. And I went, oh my, that's unreal.
That's awesome.
And then it connected the dots to other similar people, though. And that I didn't expect. And all of a sudden, now I'm introduced to other people that are big influencers.
I did discover there was at least one incident of very useful YouTube. Our 16-year-old Ashley came walking into my office one day, and she's looking at her phone. And she's looks at me. She looks back at the phone. She goes, you know, you're actually funny. I'm justified forever. A 16-year-old.
Okay. So now we're back to the business of business here. Doug, you and I, you invited a number of investors. We went to Washington and spoke to Fannie Mae. And it was interesting, at least from my perspective, there was... The first meeting seemed like we were, it was a little perfunctory, and we were, you know, not really taken seriously. By the third one, there was a very different meeting where they had separate groups, and they went and they discussed it, and they came back with really good questions. So I wanted to know, what is your sense of Fannie Mae's attitude toward growing that side of the business to investors? And the other thing is, what is the journey to going to a private company again?
Well, as you probably know, the regulator has said that we can't do any business outside of our current footprint, which is the 10 maximum loans to investor. That is a rule that has been imposed on us by the past regulator. The current regulator hasn't said anything about that yet. Because he's been focused very much on what it would take to release us back into the private sector in a more competitive market. So I think the most important thing to watch for is the issuance of the capital rule, which has been a matter of a proposed rule and taken commentary from the public on that proposed rule. Then they will have to issue a final rule. When they do, it suggests to private investors what level of capitalization and the potential returns that we could offer to a private investor. So that's the first thing that has to happen. It may happen this fall. If the rule is reissued, that will delay the whole process. But there is a move to allow us to start to retain some earnings, which would build capital. Because the two agencies, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, together, given the current level of capital, which is, you know, $3 or $4 billion, would need to have many, many times that. In fact, a single capital rule would be the biggest, single capital raise, if they were attempting to recapitalize both agencies in one raise, would be the largest IPO in the history of the United States. So that's simply not going to happen. So they're making progress in that direction, but there will be some time.
Okay. John, wanted to ask you about, I want to kind of deal with the household and then go into the rental market. So how is the makeup of what we think of as a household? You know, when I was a kid, it was, you know, two kids, 2.3 kids, two adult parents. So what is the makeup now of America's household, and does that lend itself more to more rental households?
Well, I do think we're going to see more rental households. Some of the data is just like one line, like number of people per household and stuff. So it's very misleading, but you got to drill into it. So the seniors are going down, the number of people per household, but they are tending to rent out rooms in their house. That's the fastest growing landlord at Airbnb is seniors with a mortgage. And I think you're going to see, someone just raised their hand over there. That's me. No, seriously, this is going to grow. There's more than, conservatively we calculate, there's 44 million empty bedrooms in homeowners' homes right now, and people are retiring and need another 10 grand a year, and I think you're going to see a lot more of that. And then the baby boomers are really the only generation around the world or ever in America who left home as soon as they possibly could. Everybody else stayed with their family.
As long as they possibly can.
Yeah. Well, if you look around the rest of the world and you look at the people that are moving here, they live multi-generationally because it's smart and I like my family. I think we're going back to that. I mean, we make fun of some of the millennials with living with mom and dad, but mom and dad are okay with it. The millennials are okay with it. It's saving money. It's smart. So I think you're going to see bigger households when you strip out that retirement who's become single because one person passed away.
Okay. The businesses that got involved in buying rental inventory, first time or first round of homes were bought below replacement cost.
Right.
Were most of those bought to keep or to flip?
You should ask the audience. That would be one of your poll questions here. In fact, I did ask the audience this last year. You let me do that. And if you, for sure, home prices were falling this year, would you be a seller? And most of you in the room when I asked that said I would not. The big institutions are not. They cannot because they have bonds secured by all those real estate. So they cannot. And if you're a REIT, there's a huge tax penalty if you start doing it. So there's no threat of Invitation Homes or American Homes for Rent playing that game. But what you're also alluding to is a part of our business that is just ridiculously exploding, which is this new trend to build homes with the intent to rent them out. It's not happening here in California. It's happening around the rest of the country. So the whole thesis of buying below replacement cost is shot when you're building it. But there's a lot of capital on Wall Street in this environment that says, hey, if I can get a brand new home with low maintenance and a yield of maybe 5 or 6%, I'm feeling okay about that versus some of the other investment opportunities that are out there. And there's a lot of money chasing that deal right now. Literally, I bet we've done 60 studies for people in the last 18 months exploring build to rent.
When you go to build to rent and you build a new house, first of all, when they're buying REOs and they kept them, they were all scattered. And now you're building them, you have a choice, so do they have a preference of the choice?
I mean, think of it like a luxury apartment complex. Is it idiotic to be building luxury apartment complexes? No. You know, every neighborhood could probably use a brand new rental neighborhood where all the homes are next to each other with some amenities. And I've learned some pretty interesting things on the consumer side too. When a consumer moves into your neighborhood and is the renter, you kind of look at them like, ah, that's the renter, they're transient, they don't feel as welcome. Seriously, when they move into some of these neighborhoods in Texas where everybody else is a renter, they've never felt as at home. They have block parties, the whole thing, there's none of that kind of taint. And these are professional landlords that take care of them. So there is a market for this. I actually think 10 years from now, we may be talking about it getting overbuilt though, just like luxury apartments get overbuilt from time to time.
Is the builder the end owner or is he building for a fee to somebody else?
So these are all, it's interesting, they're all brand new companies that are formed that don't know how to build houses. And so, So they've contracted with big companies. Lennar is building for two of them. Toll Brothers is building for BB Living. Taylor Morrison is building for Christopher Todd Communities. So they are hiring builders to build for them, and it looked really good on Wall Street because they're booking it as a sale. Seriously, so there's a new buyer for a new home now. It's these companies that are taking 100 homes as soon as you're done with them. And they're going to their trades and saying, guess what? I'm going to lock you up for the whole year. I can keep your entire best crew busy all year long. They're getting better pricing from the trades because of it, too.
When we're looking at new homes, are we talking, when you said amenities, so I guess I wanted to get, as you know, I've bought some lots and built some rentals. But those are just houses, you know. Are you talking about where these houses are, they have all the whistles and bells, like almost like the villages?
They don't have 50,000 golf carts like the villages. We've actually done a report on this. So there's segmentation developing. So there's the 600 square foot home with a small yard that's pulling the person out of an apartment complex for the same rent who didn't want to be in an apartment but wanted a place for the barbecue and a dog. There's 7-unit-long townhomes. Some of them look like, look like vertical or horizontal apartment complexes. And then there are traditional homes, and each builder actually is specializing in one or the other. The ones that are actually doing luxury houses, they're very, very few and far between. There's a community, a company out of the Midwest who's built 90 of these already, 90 neighborhoods built to rent homes, all townhomes.
Okay. One more for you. And I don't mean to have anybody dominate, but there's just some subjects that's your expertise, so bear with me. In an interview, there was a couple of things that caught my attention. This was from Brookfield Residential, and he had bought over 100 malls.
Yeah.
To do what with?
So we all know what's happened to the mall industry. So General Growth filed bankruptcy, 165 malls. Brookfield Residential, which has a longer than usual investment horizon, picked them up. So, you know, it was a bidding process, so they probably paid more than the next guy. But they got 150 million square feet of retail surrounded by 300 million square feet of vacant land. And we coined this term suburban, where people wanting to live closer in. These malls are in awesome locations. They're redeveloping 12 of them already. Interestingly, they picked the 12 of the best, not 12 of the worst, to get started because they wanted a good footprint here. And you're going to see apartment complexes and other things popping up on the outer edges of these parking lots now that the other bidders weren't putting into their pro forma. I think it's going to be super smart. And the CEO of Brookfield is speaking at our conference in November on this topic.
Now, the other thing that he said was surprising to me. He expressed concern about the potential of having huge competitors come in the marketplace. Is he not a huge competitor? How big is big?
Yeah, I think that, we titled that one the biggest checkbook in home building.
Yes.
Yeah, but there's maybe about 15 companies that could compete with him.
But he's talking about Amazon, and I don't know how to...
That's a different issue. So they're a home builder too, and they've partnered with Amazon and others, and he's very... I mean, Amazon could build a home for no profit and be totally happy if they set you up to be doing all the purchases you ever do for the rest of your life in that house. And you laugh, but that is what they're trying to do with Alexa. So that is part of their strategy. And they want to know, well, the air filter needs to be replaced. You get an alert. We'll put you on a subscription for the air filter. There's a lot of things Amazon can do here to disrupt the industry. And he was watching it carefully because he's partnered with Lennar and Brookfield and others. Amazon has kind of learning the business.
The Norris Group originates and services loans in California and Florida under California DRE License 01219911, Florida Mortgage Lender License 1577, and NMLS License 1623669. For more information on hard money lending, go to thenorrisgroup.com and click the Hard Money tab.
The Norris Group would like to thank its gold sponsors for supporting I Survived Real Estate, Coldwell Banker Town & Country, Inaday Development, Inland Valley Association of Realtors, Keystone CPA, Las Brisas Escrow, LA South RIA, Michael Ryan & Associates, NorCal RIA, NSDREI, Orange County Real Estate Investors, Pacific Premier Bank, Pasadena Phoebe, Shenbaum Group, SJREI, Spinnaker Loans, South OC RIA, UDirect IRA Services, White House Catering, Wilson Investment Properties,
See isurvivedrealestate.com for event information.
For more information on hard money loans and upcoming events with the Norris Group, check out thenorrisgroup.com. For information on passive investing with trust deeds, visit tngtrustdeeds.com.